Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin. Co-hosting with me today is Kristen Polacy, chiropractic practitioner, new doula, and mother. And our guest today is Laura Ehrlich. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
You are a specialist in Chinese medicine, and you focus on infertility, obstetrics, and women's health in general. And in addition to practicing, you also teach, and you also wrote a book, Feed Your Fertility, which is the first of apparently many books coming from you.
Let's hope.
Yeah. Tell me more. First of all, how did you get interested in Chinese medicine?
It was a fairly organic evolution, I would say. I did my undergraduate degree in classical theater, and upon graduating, quickly discovered that that meant I was a college-educated waitress for most of my life.
Yeah.
And so I started looking for something
else. It helps with calculating the totals and things.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, presenting yourself at all times. But I started looking for something that I would find a little bit more intellectually stimulating. I was living in New York at the time, and so I decided to attend the Swedish Institute of Massage Therapy.
Oh, yeah.
And famous school. And a big part of that curriculum was actually an introduction to the meridian system, the basics of Chinese medicine, and learning shiatsu massage. So I kind of fell in love with Chinese medicine through that training. And then as soon as I graduated, I found an interest in prenatal massage while I was studying there. And then I kind of hooked up with a couple of women who were doulas that were becoming midwives, and they were also massage therapists. So I began studying with them and learned labor massage and postpartum techniques for helping women with various conditions. And then I started apprenticing with them, and then eventually, a couple of years later, moved back to Los Angeles and became a doula. And then I tried to do all the things. I was doing doula work, I had a massage practice, and I was doing repertory theater.
Oh, wow. And you never dropped the theater.
I attempted to do it all, and then I sort of woke up at the end of one arduous season on call, stressed out of my mind, and went, you know, something's got to give here. I have to choose. And holistic medicine was just more of a calling, ultimately. And I'm super grateful for my theater background, but was definitely ready to let it go.
Do you feel like your theater background helps you in practice?
Oh, tremendously. I think it helps me as a communicator with my patients. And I, you know, my interest was always classical theater, so I'm classically trained with a big focus in Shakespeare. And I think I'm a very linguistic person. I learned Spanish in an immersion program starting in kindergarten. So I think I'm somebody who's always had an ear for language and trying to understand difficult concepts and being able to convey them to people. So
I don't know if you know this. I have a theater background as well.
Oh, that's really? I didn't know that.
In college, I was a drama major. But I never expected to do theater or drama, but then here we are with a podcast and a YouTube series and documentaries and a comedy show, and it just here you go. You never get rid of it, really.
No, you don't. And I'm so grateful for it because I feel like, I'm sure you feel this way too. I think it's one of the things that has set me apart as a practitioner because I'm not afraid to get up and teach and talk about things.
And thank goodness for that, because you have so much valuable information that's hard to come by, which is why I'm so glad to have you here today.
Thank you.
I really want to pick your brain about Chinese medicine in general.
Okay.
And then, probably in our second half, Chinese medicine specific to the various stages of pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum breastfeeding.
Okay.
I mean, you know so much about it. It's what you live and breathe every day. And you teach.
And you
teach other acupuncturists in Chinese medicine. So if we start with the basics, Chinese medicine as a label, what's under that umbrella?
What's under that umbrella is really a series of modalities that all come together to treat the whole person. And so that includes acupuncture, of course, herbal medicine. And I would say those are the two primary things that we think of with Chinese medicine. But in addition to that, there's a whole nutrition component with Chinese medicine. There is body work techniques like Tui Na, Gua Sha, cupping. Those are all more modalities that tend to be used for musculoskeletal conditions or various pain issues as well.
So if we can break them down, acupuncture, starting with acupuncture, for people who are not familiar with acupuncture, how do you define it? What is it?
In the simplest terms, acupuncture is the insertion of very fine, sterile, one-time use needles into various points along the body that comprise what we call a meridian system or a channel system. And to me, the most appropriate comparison would be the cardiovascular system in our body or the nervous system in the body, meaning your blood flows to every cell in your body. It interacts with every cell in your body, moves in and out. Same with our nervous system. The nerves start somewhere, but then they end up touching every cell in the body. And we can't really live or function without those systems being in place. The meridian system is kind of like that. It's a thoroughfare of energy that travels through the body. And it also interacts with and touches every cell, every organism within the body.
So and except for anomalies, every person has the same map of blood flow. Every person has the same map of blood flow. You have your major nerve superhighways, and then coming off of them, there are branches. And we all have the same branches. They're named and labeled, and you can predict if something's going on with one particular roadway, then you're going to have very specific symptoms. And if you correct that, then those symptoms can go away.
And the meridian system functions exactly the same way.
With
we all have the same
energy.
Meridians. We all have the same roadways. We all have the same points along them. And they can become blocked just in the same way that a physical part of the body can become blocked. And essentially, if we can rebalance that system, if you think about like an electric fence, for example, an electric fence is shuttling energy back and forth. If there's a place in that fence where the electrical line gets broken, then the electricity can't make it across, right? It's going to get stuck right there. So the use of needles, which are made of metal, are great conductors of that electricity. And so by finding a place where there's not enough energy coming through, or maybe there's a surge of energy, there's too much coming through, and using the needles to kind of modulate that, the way that that energy goes back and forth, you've essentially fixed that spot in the fence where things are broken, and the whole thing can go back to kind of smoothly flowing.
And you do that with those tiny needles.
We do that with those tiny needles and where we choose to put them. And there are different techniques. There are different approaches to acupuncture. I practice a more classical style of acupuncture that's looking at the meridian system as a whole.
A holistic acupuncture.
Yeah, if you will. The more contemporary acupuncture, which has evolved since the People's Revolution in China, when General Mao, who took over, decided that he wanted Western medicine and Eastern medicine to be far more similar, changed a lot of things about the way Chinese medicine was taught.
Oh, interesting.
And so it became a little bit more like Western medicine, where we kind of say like a pill for every ill. Chinese medicine kind of became a point for every ill. So I can choose this point for cramps and that point for headaches and this point for nausea, as opposed to the more classical approach, which has a lot of influence from Taoism and a more kind of spiritual perspective. That was eliminated from the vernacular and from the pedagogy because they didn't want it to seem too esoteric. And
I got the tagline, a stick for every ick. Thank you very much.
That's a good one.
Well, thank you very much. I do want to point out these needles are tiny, right? I don't love being poked by needles. I don't like having blood drawn. Oddly enough, I don't mind doing it to other people, but I don't have a problem. I don't love needles being stuck into my body. Acupuncture needles don't typically bother me at all.
No, they're
and they're
very different.
So thin, they're like a hair. You could flex it like a hair, and you can fit a whole bunch of them into the hypodermic needle that they use to draw blood. I think sometimes people picture needles like
they get confused
tons of
about
needles
that.
Poking out of you like a pincushion.
Yep.
So acupuncture is one of several modalities under Chinese medicine. And then you also talked about herbal medicine. How are Chinese herbs different than other herbs that exist?
They're not different insofar as the plants are necessarily so different. There's a tremendous amount of crossover between, say, Ayurvedic herbs, Chinese herbs, even Western herbs. The thing that makes Chinese herbal medicine its own thing is that the herbs are used in formulas. So a lot of times with Western medicine, we see herbs used, or Western herbology, you'll use a single herb. You'll use red raspberry leaf, for example, and just use that. In Chinese medicine, we are always combining herbs together, and it's the energetic relationship between the herbs in addition to the actual physical properties of the herbs that causes the impact that you're trying
to
make.
Whoa, that's a heavy sentence. Can you break it down?
Sure. So by using a lot of different herbs together, we're creating a medicinal effect that is different than if you just took one at a time. So if I were to combine something that causes the blood to, say, quicken a little bit, but that simultaneously I'm using another herb that maybe causes the blood to be nourished or mm-hmm. to bring more nutrients, then I'm using these two things together to quickly deliver
more nutrients.
Okay. To a specific part of the body. And the sages and masters that came up with this Materia Medica thousands of years ago, when the Materia Medica is basically the big compendium of herbs that are part of the Chinese medical pharmacopoeia, they really related to these herbs in an energetic sense. So they're not just looking at like, oh, this herb has whatever specific molecular chemical compounds that have a physiologic effect. They're saying this herb will increase your energy, your chi, for example, or that this herb will clear emotional blockages, or this herb might, I don't know, whatever it is, help to transform somebody from a state of physical pain to a state of non-pain, but in an energetic sense, not just in a literal sense. Now, interestingly enough, as time's gone by and we've had the opportunity to study these in a more molecular way, the things that they were said to do, they really do. So that's the
really
other kind of amazing thing. I mean, even
how far back do these herbs date, the use of Chinese herbs?
I think close to 3,000 years.
Wow.
In terms of what we have written down.
So they didn't even have Google.
They didn't have Google. There was no Dr. Google at that time where people could
It's amazing how
second
they figured
guess
it out.
You. Or, yeah. Yep.
Is there interplay between the herbs and the acupuncture?
You know, that's an interesting question. I strongly believe that there is. To the degree that the acupuncture is the driver of the resources and the herbs are the resources themselves. So The acupuncture, if I'm choosing an acupuncture prescription for somebody, I am trying to direct their chi and their blood and whatever vital, you know, essences that they have in their body to a certain area or to a certain channel system, because that's where I see that there's an imbalance. And then I'm choosing herbs that resonate with that as well. It's different in the West than it is in China, though, because in China, you are either an herbalist or an acupuncturist.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
a
you
specialist.
Don't, both do not come together.
That's like over here, like you can't just be an orthopedist, you have to be a thumb specialist.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like down to the, oh, not just the thumb, I'm the nail
The particular
guy.
Joint.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Oh. So just this one right here.
And in China, herbs are used for internal medicine and acupuncture is used for more physical medicine. Typically, you wouldn't be using herbs to treat. I mean, you wouldn't be using herbs to treat back pain necessarily, and you wouldn't be using acupuncture to treat preeclampsia or nausea or infertility or recurrent pregnancy loss. You'd only use herbs for that. Now, because in the West, everybody is so stressed out, and because from my perspective, the autonomic nervous system is the real player here, that fight or flight versus rest and relax state that people are in. And the more we can be in the rest and relax mode, the more our bodies have the capacity to heal. And I think that that's where acupuncture shines. Acupuncture literally transitions people, even if it's only for half an hour once a week, into that state where their body recognizes like, oh, I'm okay. Everything's okay. Mm. And from here, I can heal. My body has the capacity within itself to change or to do what it needs to do.
I would take 5 minutes once a month.
Five minutes once a month.
I'm glad you noticed that other people
Elliot.
Are stressed out, not just me. I thought it was just me. You mentioned the herbal pharmacopoeia, mm-hmm. which sounds like something I want to buy for my family for Thanksgiving.
It's not.
A pharmacopoeia. How many herbs are there? Are we talking about a dozen herbs? Hundreds of herbs?
Hundreds and hundreds of herbs. I mean,
they're not just
the
single herbs, right?
Yeah, of course.
Blends
So there's single herbs, and that's in school we learn single herbs by category, and I would imagine in the single herb department we're learning at least 400 or 500. And again, we're just learning what we're being tested on for this state board. So as a practitioner, I've learned, you know, about lots and lots of different herbs or a lot of herbs that are not used anymore because they're toxic and, you know, we don't want to poison people. There are a lot of herbs that are
do no harm
is the goal. there's a lot of herbs that are derived from animal products and things that are now considered taboo, and we don't use those here in the States.
Oh, really?
But they are.
I was wondering how you deal with quality control and safety.
Yeah, quality control is really, really important to me as a practitioner who's working primarily with women who are either trying to become pregnant or already are pregnant. So quality control is vital. I manage quality control by using vendors that are testing all of their products already. So I don't use raw herbs in their dry bulk form, even though there are some vendors out there who do assure that those products are safe and et cetera. You know, we know that the planet is pretty polluted at this mm-hmm. point. So I would rather give my patients a product that has gone through a rigorous testing system. So I use when I'm prescribing single herbs and combining them together to make a formula, I use freeze-dried granules. So they've already – somebody picked them, and then they decocted them into a tea. Mm-hmm. And then they tested that final batch of product
for purity and potency,
for pollutants, for heavy metals, for making sure that it's actually the herb it's supposed to be. So we know the whole molecular chemical breakdown, and we know that it's passed the test of being safe to ingest. And then they freeze dry it. So what we get are these granules of the herbs already made into a tea.
And you put
just add water.
Okay.
And drink it. So
you could mix various granules to create a multi-herb.
Right.
Formula.
So that's what I do. I have like a big wall of herbs in my pharmacy.
Does it smell when it's freeze-dried? Like that herbal?
It doesn't smell the way it does when you're at home boiling it in your ceramic kettle and then it reeks up your whole house. It certainly smells when you're going to drink it.
No, but I've walked into herbal dispensaries that have the fresh herbs, and it smells kind of amazing in there.
Yes. Yeah. So these don't smell the same way because they're in freeze-dried. They're in
granules.
Little packets that you can't smell them when you first – until you open the pack. You don't smell them.
Hmm.
But when something is freeze-dried, it's at the highest potency or the highest
– It is. Yeah, it's
value.
Highly concentrated. Yeah. So it's just – you just have to add back a little bit of water and then drink it that way. The formulas – I mean, the herbs that we use, the vendor that we use actually supplies the hospitals in Hong Kong, for example.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, I'm a big stickler about finding the highest quality. Yeah. I also use a lot of capsules because – even just reconstituting herbs with water, they still taste pretty bad to the Western palate. I was amazed when I visited China and Korea that the herbs that we like plug our noses over and gag and think are so disgusting, they cook with.
Oh,
so
really?
It's
just
part
even
of
on their
their
pasta? Then just,
you know, like chicken that's made with like angelica, dongui, or other herbs that we would never consume for the flavor. We would mm-hmm. just consume for the medicinal purposes of it.
That's interesting.
So for them, it doesn't taste gross.
Interesting. Well, mm-hmm. we have different palates. I think all acupuncturists are sticklers. Thank you very much. I'll be here all night. moving on. You have to learn Chinese to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? I mean, it's a mm-hmm. difficult language because I watch Ni Hao Kai Lan and it's not easy.
It's not easy.
What's going on.
So we get like a very baby version of Chinese. There are some amazing scholars in our field who have taken the time to truly learn Chinese and to be able to translate the texts, and that's why we have access to so much of this information. I have not done that, but.
But you still have to learn some Chinese to be able to...
We have to learn what's called pinyin. So, mm-hmm. And sometimes when people will ask me what an herb is, and I kind of only know the name in pinyin. I can't always remember like the Latin translation, but there's the pinyin, which is essentially the Chinese characters translated into close enough English. So
okay, transliteration.
Dong Gui, for example, is... Or Dong Quai, some people call it. But Dong Gui is the pinyin version of that.
I see.
But it's really Angelica. Angelica is the Latin name of that. Or Bai Xiao is peony. So
that's what
we
I would
learn.
Have
it's
that?
Very similar.
That's what
sounding.
I would have thought. Bai Xiao just sounds like peony.
Yeah, doesn't it? So that's what we have to learn in school. We have to figure out, you know, through a variety of acronyms and other ways of remembering, you know, what the pinyin is, what the Latin is, what the English is, what the properties are, what the energetics are, what they do, what you combine
really,
them with. It's crazy.
It's a lot to know.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, you also did massage, and, you know, just thinking about all the muscles and the origin, insertion, and action, that's a lot to know. But with the herbs, there's so many, and there's so many properties related to them. And I imagine some go well together and some don't.
Yeah, you do well have together. To know about interactions. But I think, as with any specialty, I mean, gosh, if I was trying to do like cardiology and pediatrics and whatever else, you know, whatever other specialty simultaneously, I would probably lose my mind. I have a very basic understanding of what to give someone if they have high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. But that's not my specialty. So if somebody was really hypertensive and I couldn't get in front of it, I'd send them to someone who specializes in that. So as a specialist, there are, you know, a handful of formulas that I use and modify on a regular basis, maybe 20, as opposed to the hundreds that I had to learn in school.
And you see the same things over and over again, which are the things we're going to talk about shortly.
Yeah.
You mentioned a third component, because we talked about acupuncture with those tiny hair thin needles. We talked about and the meridians. We talked about herbal medicine. And then you said there are some bodywork modalities like Tuinan, cupping. Can you tell me a little bit more about those?
Yeah, so those are modalities that we often use to deal with musculoskeletal conditions, much like you guys. I mean, there's even a component of it that typically isn't practiced in the West, and I'm not trained in it at all, but that's quite similar to chiropractic, where they are like doing moving bones and adjusting.
Well, because we live in California, I do some herbal medicine.
Oh, yeah. See, there you go. But I do not adjust people.
But not at the office.
I send them to you.
Just, not
that's
at the
out
office.
Of my realm.
Just on Melrose. Yeah.
So Tuina is it's kind of a big umbrella, really. I mean, it's body work in general. It's body work along specific channels. There's a variation of Tuina specific to pediatrics that uses little tiny tools to kind of get the meridians activated without using needles. Cupping is using suction cups that can be – we can either these days use like a pump to pump up the – just the suction, or fire cupping, which is the traditional method where you take a, like, it's like a little glass fishbowl and you light a cotton ball on fire and you stick it in the cup and then you stick it on the person's back or wherever part of them you're treating, and it creates this suction.
Yeah, where you don't feel the heat, but it sucks out all
the
air.
You don't feel the heat, but it sucks all the air out. It creates a vacuum, and when you place it on the skin, it makes a big suction of the skin. It generally causes big purple round marks.
Giant hickeys.
But most people have seen them on TV on various celebrities.
I remember, Gwyneth Paltrow at the
Oscars. Paltrow on the red carpet.
And a lot of athletes recently.
A lot of athletes.
You know, over the years.
So it's typically used for
pain. It's also great
for
playing Twister on somebody. All those little spots. Red hand on deep purple.
It works great for muscle spasms, for back pain, for actually really, really well for lung conditions like bronchitis, pneumonia, that kind of thing.
What's the theory, though?
What's that?
What's the theory of cupping? What is it physiologically doing?
It's physiologically pulling the fascia and bringing a ton of blood flow into an area where there's stagnation. And then when you release it, it's releasing it all. So it's not too dissimilar from, you know, sticking your elbow into a point for a long period of time, and then when you release it, you get a big rush of blood in, which clears out all of the toxins.
Sounds like a combination of it sounds like a reverse massage instead of
kind
pushing
of as a
in,
reverse
like
massage.
That's
a good way to think of it. Yeah, it's pulling toxicity out of the muscle tissue, out of the fascia, and kind of helping it to unstick so that then you can get more blood flow.
So when somebody goes to visit an acupuncturist or a Chinese medical practitioner, these are basically the tools of the trade.
For the most part. Yeah, and nutrition as well. Not all acupuncturists deal in nutrition. I do a lot of nutrition.
Nutrition in terms of – what do you mean by that?
I mean really taking a look at people's diets and figuring out if they're eating appropriately for whatever it is that they're trying to do. A lot of women who are trying to become pregnant, for example, are not eating enough fat and protein in their diets. They're trying to not gain any weight or whatever they're doing. You know, there's and there's a specific Chinese medicine approach to nutrition that tends to kind of veer away from veganism, for example, and says that most people really need those resources from some animal product. It doesn't necessarily mean that they can't be vegetarian, but that it requires a lot of conscious planning if that is the way that you're eating. And
but I think that's true in general. If you cut out anything from the food supply, then
absolutely.
You probably have to take whatever nutrients would have been there and find another way to.
Right. Right. But some things are hard to replace. So when you completely take out some of the essential fatty acids and things that you find in certain animal products, it's hard to replace those in nature. And I know there's a lot of vegans out there who disagree with that, but that's the Chinese perspective about on it. So kind of looking at people's diets, what they're eating, making sure they're eating enough and frequently enough, a lot of nutrition in the first trimester to help manage nausea and fatigue and those kinds of symptoms, kind of trying to stay in front of it rather than waiting until the nausea really kicks in and then trying to figure out how to get rid of it.
My nutritionist is a huge believer in lots of different colors in the diet, eating lots of different colors. But then I found out sprinkles don't count.
They don't.
Darn it.
That would be so great.
Neither do crunch berries.
They did.
Right? Every morning?
Wouldn't that be
every
awesome?
Color?
Sprinkles on your crunch berries.
Yeah, of course. Laura, I've already learned so much about the basic understanding of Chinese medicine. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I really want to dig next into your expertise into the pre- and postnatal specialty. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back with Laura Ehrlich. I have an incredible offer for you for my friends at Needed. An astounding 95% of women aren't meeting their omega-3 needs. Omega-3 fatty acids, especially DHA and EPA, are crucial for both mother and baby. They support brain and eye health, maternal mood, immunity, and much more. But it can be hard to get enough omega-3 from diet alone, especially during pregnancy when many people are averse to eating fish. And if you've ever taken a fish oil pill, you know just how unpleasant that can be. That's why I'm excited to share that my friends at Needed have revolutionized the omega-3 supplement with two different options designed specifically for mamas. An omega-3 powder that blends into smoothies and a pill option that tastes like fresh citrusy bergamot. Both are sustainably sourced from vegan algae, not fish. Both are great options for nausea and sensitive prone mamas. Needed's omega-3 powder is delivered in liposomes, nature's very cool way of protecting and delivering omega-3, just like in breast milk. Needed's omega-3 is clinically proven to be 5 times better absorbed than fish oil pills. The powder is mild tasting and it pairs great with Needed's prenatal multi-powder and collagen protein powder in a daily smoothie. If powder isn't your thing, Needed's got you covered with those omega-3 plus capsules, which have a pleasant citrus flavor. Needed is sharing an awesome pre-order discount just for my listeners. Buy two, get one free on either omega-3 option, powder or capsules. You can stock up on either one or try them both. With this exclusive discount, use code 3BERLIN, the number 3BERLIN at thisisneeded.com. Put 3 omega-3s in your cart. Use the code number 3BERLIN at thisisneeded.com. Buy two, get one free. Welcome back to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin, here with co-host Kristen Polacy and our guest, Laura Ehrlich. We're talking about herbology and Chinese medicine for pregnancy and birth and postpartum. So the first thing that comes to mind is, I mean, you mentioned earlier acupuncture, herbal medicine, and body work. Herbal medicine is one that gets everybody nervous because during pregnancy, everybody who makes any product, no matter what it is, always says on there, you know, be cautious during pregnancy or ask your medical doctor before you touch this product or take it or breathe it or sleep on it. And my sense is that when you ask your medical doctor about Chinese herbs that they can't pronounce and never heard of before, there's no way that they can give you an informed answer about that. So how do we know? I mean, are the herbs safe to use during pregnancy, not safe? Are some safe and others not safe?
Well, I think that it's very, very important to work with a trained herbalist in the same way that you would work with a trained medical doctor. So, you know, you wouldn't go and get a prescription for a pharmaceutical medication from somebody who didn't have the training to provide that to you. And in the same way, you probably wouldn't ask your acupuncturist whether or not you should change your dose of Synthroid. That's the doctor's job. And so one of the things that, you know, as a profession, I think we're still working on is helping people to understand the level of training that goes into being a Chinese herbal medicine practitioner and the amount of not only knowledge we have to have, but sourcing information, as we were talking about before, making sure that things are clean and safe and not going to harm the body. And it is challenging because Western physicians often don't realize the extent that we are trained and that we understand the herb and drug interactions if patients are taking pharmaceuticals, for example, or that we understand that they're pregnant and that there are certain things that they shouldn't take because they're pregnant. So I think first and foremost, it's really important that people don't self-prescribe. And we can find anything online now, and we can Google anything about anything. And, you know, when I have so often I get emails and text messages from my patients saying, can I take this too? And how about if I take that? And, oh, I got this thing at CVS. And I'm, you know, my answer is always, please no, because I'm already accounting for all of that stuff. All the things that you're seeking more and more for, I'm already accounting for that in the prescription that I'm providing for you and the plan that we are making. So I think one thing is that it's really important to trust, you know, work with a practitioner that has a good reputation, that you do trust, that you know has a solid background. And then as consumers, we have to decide for ourselves, am I going to look to the plumber to fix my heater, or am I going to trust that the plumber is just going to deal with the plumbing? And so we have to get to a place as a society where we accept that Chinese medicine practitioners are, in fact, highly trained medical providers. In the state of California, we're considered primary care physicians. Like, we have a tremendous amount of medical training.
That's an important note. You don't have to go to your doctor
to
get a referral to Chinese medicine.
Right. Not in California. In other states, I'm sure that's not the case. But in California, we're considered primary care providers. And in, you know, if you go to Asian countries, there's such a strong belief in Chinese medicine, and Chinese medicine and Western practitioners are side by side. If you go to a hospital, they're making decisions and you're receiving herbs and you're receiving Western medicine together. And here, that's just not part of our culture yet. So
no.
That's where a lot of the confusion and the fear comes from. But I think beyond that, the self-prescription and the sort of blanket no's that come from the Western medical community, rather than really taking the time to meet with practitioners in their community and understand what it is they're providing.
Well, I think times are changing, because one of my favorite places to eat is a restaurant called Chicken Chow, which both has like fried chicken and Chinese food.
So, for sure.
It could be a sign.
I saw teriyaki bowls and pastrami when I was driving home yesterday, actually, in one under one roof.
See, okay. Welcome to California. It starts here and then it spreads out.
So, like, I mean, so many people.
It's a great, exactly. It's a great point. Well, I would never, you know, you don't go to your OBGYN and ask about Don Quai, just the same way you don't go to your acupuncturist and ask, should I take my antidepressant during
pregnancy. If a patient asks me if they should go off their antidepressants, I tell them to call their psychiatrist.
Right.
But I trust that their psychiatrist is a board certified trained psychiatrist. And so what we're missing in the culture here is for OBGYNs to trust that the acupuncturist that you're seeing is a board certified trained acupuncturist and understands what they're doing and has the same obligation to do no harm.
And you know, we have an acupuncturist in the office also. He has so many books, and they're big, heavy books. And it's never ending, the amount of research and education and understanding that goes into it. It's a vast amount of knowledge.
Yeah, we can go on.
You made an interesting point also, that like, go out and make sure you find somebody who is or specializes. So how would somebody, if they're listening and wants to find a specialist, an acupuncturist who specializes in pregnancy or prenatal, what's the best way to do that and make sure?
Is there a formal specialty?
There is a formal specialty currently. It's growing in the U.S., but it is so far we don't have a lot of differentiation in our training. There's a move in that direction, but the training is not such that you graduate from school with a specialty per se. I knew what my specialty was going to be because I was already a doula. I was already a prenatal massage therapist. I kind of went in with blinders on and focused on this very specifically. So I had a little bit of an advantage coming out into the community. That said, there is a formal board certification that a lot of practitioners choose to go through called the American Board of Oriental Reproductive Medicine, of which I am a fellow. And so technically speaking, I am a board certified fellow of this American Board of Oriental Reproductive Medicine. And what I had to do to get to that point was sit for a super hard exam that essentially demonstrated my proficiency in reproductive medicine. Right now, the board is more focused on infertility than obstetrics, but most of my colleagues that are fellows of the board, their practice continues well into the obstetric period, sure. Even if they don't go all the way through pregnancy. So that's a good place to start, because in most communities, you'll find somebody that's aborm.org to start.
So they'll
looking.
List the people that are fellows.
So there's a list of fellows there that you can find. And so I would say, by and large, those are the people who are the most focused on the specialty. But it doesn't mean that, you know, somebody who's living in another community and has really dedicated their time to working in obstetrics or infertility and hasn't sat for this exam isn't also equally capable, but we hope that more and more people will do it so that we can start to differentiate. There's also like an orthopedic board, for example, but there's not a lot yet of...
And chiropractic too. There's not, you don't finish and then go for a long fellowship like medicine.
It's we don't get to do residencies. Line. We kind of just get thrown to the wolves. I'm sure it's the same for you guys. Like, yep. Start a business and find a specialty. Go! And you're like, what? So I feel really fortunate because it was always clear for me.
So I just want to spend the next 20 minutes walking through a pregnancy to sort of give examples of some of the scope of what we can do with Chinese medicine throughout pregnancy. In the first trimester, you're of a mostly prenatal practice and so are we. In the first trimester, the most common things people come in with are nausea, vomiting, fatigue. Is there a Chinese medical approach?
Absolutely. There's a Chinese medical approach. And the thing about the Chinese medical approach is it's going to be different for every single person. You know, so while there is a sort of compendium of herbs and acupuncture points I'm looking at, I'm going to base my treatment protocol on the way that person is presenting that day. And one of the ways I go about doing that is I feel their pulse and I look at their tongue and I talk to them and see how they're feeling. I'm looking at the color of their complexion. You know, are they pale? Are they looking kind of like green because they're so nauseated? Do they have big bags under their eyes? And so it's really at that point becomes, in addition to choosing the right points to help manage whatever that nausea is, and oftentimes we refer to it as rebellious stomach qi. And so we're choosing points to help descend the stomach qi. But often that's not enough. There's also very frequently a big emotional component to the first trimester as well, at least among my patient population, most of whom have gone through some type of a fertility struggle. Mm-hmm. So they're battling all of that too, the very frequent doctor's appointments and getting monitored really closely. And so there's a whole big stress and fear component that often comes into the first trimester as well. That's probably not true for the average lucky 26-year-old who just wanted to get pregnant and then sneezed and got pregnant. But in my population, that's not the case. So most people worked really hard to get there. And so that stress and fear is definitely playing a role in how they're feeling. And
I have some patients who don't even sneeze.
What's that?
I have some patients that don't even sneeze.
That don't even, yeah.
Yeah,
me too.
So that's interesting. It's different from person to person. And those diagnostic tools that you use, like I use a pulse to tell if somebody's alive or dead, but you can learn so much more in your training on the quality of the pulse and, tongue readings. And fatigue as well.
Fatigue as well. Oftentimes fatigue, you know, look, to a degree, it's par for the course. We can't completely take it away, but it's about helping people figure out ways to manage it better. Herbs, if possible, when somebody's really nauseous, herbs are a challenge. And so then I kind of turn to a little bit more of a Western herbal approach by doing things like single herbs like boiled ginger or peppermint or I like to use rose and mint together because it has a physical calming effect in addition to kind of being a little bit anti-nausea and cooling. So people are vomiting a lot or having acid reflux. That's a little bit more helpful than ginger, which is a really hot herb, and we wouldn't necessarily use that. So,
what happens sometimes, there's medical approaches as well. There's pharmaceutical prescriptions when nausea and vomiting gets intense to the point where it becomes dysfunctional or really uncomfortable. Is there a way to understand how the pharmaceuticals and the herbs will interact with each other?
Absolutely. And we have a lot of research on all of that. Typically speaking, in the first trimester, we're looking at things like vitamin B6 combined with, for all intents and purposes, Benadryl. You know, that's what most people are starting with for nausea. And then And the combination, for whatever reason, for some people, has that kind of anti-nausea effect or anti-emetic effect. Zofran is sometimes used, but I don't know about you. I'm seeing that used less and less because there's some research that's linking it to some adverse fetal outcomes. So Zofran seems like we're dissuading people away from that.
It's a heavy hitter, and it also seems to prevent some of the vomiting, but not necessarily the nausea. And so sometimes that ends up being counterproductive.
Yeah. Yeah. I find with most of my patients, of course, it's a spectrum. And sometimes you have people who are so sick that they're vomiting, you know, and they really need Western intervention. They need IV fluids. They need to be on really heavy duty drugs. For the average morning sickness person, I think it's really about eating very frequently, eating every 2 hours. If you wake up in the middle of the night nauseous, you get up and have a snack then too.
That's my lifestyle.
And mine.
And I've never had nausea and vomiting.
You've never had a pregnancy, baby either. So how did this happen?
Must work. What about in the second trimester, there's more pain, discomfort, sometimes headaches pop up in the first and second trimester, swelling. You mentioned the body work techniques. Do you use those during pregnancy?
Body work is great for the second trimester, especially they're starting to experience when the baby kind of pops over the top of the pubic bone and there's a little bit more of a change in posture. So massage is great during that time between acupuncture works really well for that as well.
Cupping during pregnancy?
Moxibustion. Cupping during pregnancy is okay, but not – I don't use cupping in the lower back until we're trying to get labor going.
Oh, really?
Not generally, or if I do use it, it would be very light cupping that's just trying to move things. But I think that massage and having a little bit more control over the depth of pressure and stuff is, for me, more comfortable.
How about the carpal tunnel symptoms that point up or the swelling?
Carpal
legs?
Tunnel, we mostly use acupuncture and some massage for that as well, hot and cold.
Do you get good results, or is it just kind of managing that symptom?
It depends on the severity. I have some patients where it's only been management, and they get relief like for a few hours or a day, and then you know it's kind of back to it. Some of it's their maintenance of their own condition, and are they wearing braces when they go to sleep, and are they, you know, doing all the things that they need to do to manage and prevent it? And for some people, it's just intractable. I'm sure you guys find that too, and it's so frustrating, but.
And how about herbs for that? Is there like, because it's a lot of like water retention?
Yeah, absolutely. We could definitely use herbs. We have to be careful on the anti-diuretic. I mean, the diuretic stuff is okay.
Okay.
But I don't use anything purgative. So it's kind of finding that fine line where you wouldn't want to do anything that would purge the intestines because that could potentially start contractions. But helping somebody, you know, just lose some water for sure is effective. And I do that a lot with just having them add electrolytes as well, you know, high quality electrolytes all day to their drinks and make their own electrolyte solutions and stay physically active as well. You know, sedentary pregnancies, I think, cause a lot more problems than active pregnancies.
When more of the diagnostics take place, like later in the second trimester, or as you're moving into the third trimester, blood sugar, blood pressure. Yeah. You know, sometimes it's just mildly high or low and controlled with diet or exercise. Sometimes it's more extreme. Mm-hmm. Is there Chinese medical remedies for those?
Definitely. I mean, I ideally start preparing my patients for things like gestational diabetes, blood sugar management, as soon as they stop being nauseous. You know, I don't really hound them about it too much when they are trying to get anything in. Mm-hmm. Although I have guidelines that I hope they can try to adhere to, but some people only can eat mashed potatoes. And if that's the case, then just eat the mashed potatoes you got to eat.
Yeah. Such a mashed potato eater.
Oh, me too. Right? That's what you bring up, the mashed potatoes and Cheerios. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
But, you know, as people start to feel better, then I'm really on to focusing on minimizing sugar, not a high refined carbohydrate diet at all. So to some degree, gestational diabetes, we don't know what's necessarily causing it, but I do think that women can manage their blood sugar, and the better job they do of that in the second trimester leading up to being tested for gestational diabetes, the better shot they have of
There's a nutritional element of what you do.
Big, big nutritional element. And there are definitely herbs for managing blood sugar as well, but I wouldn't prescribe those unless I knew there was something going on and they weren't taking – I wouldn't prescribe blood sugar-lowering herbs in conjunction with like metformin or something else that they were taking.
Or insulin.
Well, insulin, then we're on to a whole other – far more serious situation. That's right. Pretty rare in my practice.
You know, it's rare, but I mean, in my practice, I don't see a lot of insulin for gestational diabetes, but it sort of depends who their practitioner is, who their medical practitioner is.
Yeah.
Some of the practices are very conservative, and even with a little bit of spike in blood sugar, they like to insulin it down.
Yeah, my preference would always be to try a dietary approach, like really give that a good try first.
Absolutely. What about itchiness, itchy belly and things like
that?
Yeah,
itchiness is a big one that I've had quite a bit of success herbally with the itchy stuff.
Are some of the herbs topical or are they all tea and
herbs
ingested?
can easily be made into compresses. There are plenty of topical herbs. There are companies that take Chinese herbs and turn them into topical solutions. Or powders, or that you make into a plaster or lotions or whatever. So Chinese herbs are definitely used in a topical way, or you can add them to a bath and take them in a bath. But a lot of times that itchy thing is coming from the liver and the gallbladder. And mm-hmm. So we treat the liver and the gallbladder herbally, and then most people are able to get
cleanse.
Some relief. So detoxing in pregnancy is not a good idea, and I would never recommend that anyone do that without working with a skilled practitioner, but it's very gentle cleansing. And again, with acupuncture and herbs, we're looking at the energetics, not just the physical properties. So I'm not going to put somebody on a massive gallbladder cleanse, but I can put them on herbs that what we would say move liver qi or help the gallbladder to function a little bit better.
To
clear heat, that's a term that we would use in Chinese medicine to hear clear heat and stagnation from the liver and the gallbladder. And it sounds totally voodoo and weird because it doesn't align with what we're used to talking about in terms of medicine, but it's quite effective.
Cholestasis.
Same
gallbladder.
Same concept, we would just address it that way. And at some point, it may not work. You know, I've had patients who've had their gallbladders removed while pregnant. It's mm-hmm. not ideal, yep. but it can be done. But usually, if we catch it early, we can get in front of it. The hardest cases are when people call and say, I have had a rash for 9 weeks and I'm dying here and nothing's working. And can't, that's a lot to get in front of. It's always easier to get in front of things before they get too bad.
What about low hemoglobin or thrombocytopenia, low platelets?
Sure. A lot of the herbs have properties in them that will help the body's blood to be more nourished, to help increase hemoglobin, to help increase iron levels, and that have a good amount of iron in them. And again, we look at diet like crazy around that stuff as well, making sure that people are eating an iron-rich diet and using things like bone broth and really mineral-rich foods to try to make sure that they're nourishing themselves properly, because we don't live in a world that's about that. We think we can take a prenatal vitamin and cover our nutritional needs, and that's not true.
I just have a patient right now who's like sort of risked out of a home birth because her hemoglobin's too low.
Wow, and that's really too bad.
I was thinking about her on my way here because, it seems like Chinese medicine has solutions that are help build up your iron and your blood.
But again, it would be something you'd want to look at earlier on if possible. If at 37 weeks, it's probably you're not going to convince 38. Yeah, you're probably not going to convince a midwife that you turned it around that fast. So
right,
you want to be starting on this stuff
earlier,
sooner, much earlier in pregnancy.
Go for it.
The herbs also then would help with immune function, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Also, which is something that's lower during pregnancy.
Absolutely.
Does that help? I guess, do you start that also earlier, or is that something you just think about in general when you're treating a pregnant woman?
It's something that I think about in general. It's something I think about seasonally as well.
Okay.
Like at this time of year, I'm really thinking about all my patients and what they're going to do going forward. So I have a lot more of them on immune supporting herbs or increase their vitamin D and, supplements, looking at their supplements, looking at their diet, making sure they're getting enough sleep and rest. And it's a lot of re-education that we can't just rely on NyQuil and
or the flu shot
or all the different things that that Western medicine throws at us as a way to suppress symptoms, where it's much better to have a healthy microbiome and a healthy physiology moving into these, then your body can manage it when it comes.
How about hemorrhoids and varicose veins?
Varicose veins are really hard to treat in pregnancy. I found if they're really painful, we actually sometimes will bleed them with a little lancet to just kind of like ease off some of the pressure. But it's awfully difficult to treat in pregnancy because as soon as somebody stands up again, they're kind of dealing with that same pressure on the veins.
Mm-hmm.
Hemorrhoids, I've had a lot of success helping women with hemorrhoids.
How do you do it?
Mostly with herbs, but also with acupuncture. There's a technique of using... No, not right in.
Okay.
Not right in. No.
It's already a pain in the
arse. There has to be some channel to
We use points along the channel that relates to lifting the energy in that region of the body.
Remote control.
Yes, precisely.
I understand. I mean, it's a big problem.
It is a big problem. And again, it's one of those things where it's if somebody comes in when they have the first sign of a hemorrhoid, we're going to have a much easier time than if they come in when they have an exploding hemorrhoid, you know, and they're in agony and they can't sit down. And yes, we can get in front of it, but it's, you know, it's sometimes, and other times it's just management.
So getting closer to labor, first of all, when labor, preeclampsia, signs of preeclampsia show up, you know, you don't often have a lot of time to work with. Is that a time to check out the acupuncturist and you know, are there things that you can do that sort of fend that off a little bit?
Sometimes. I think it just depends, again, what the woman's overall state of health is and why it's happening. High blood pressure, oftentimes we can address, and that's enough. But if somebody's heading aggressively into a state of preeclampsia and their liver enzymes are changing and their platelets are dropping, and, you know, at that point we kind of leave it to Western medicine, because Western medicine is really acute trauma medicine at its core, and it really saves lives when it comes to that kind of thing. So
sure, but even in Western medicine, in the pre-state, sometimes they notice little changes here, a little bit of
urine
change.
And by all means, at that point, acupuncture, nutrition, stress management, adequate rest, all of that stuff can play a role, helping with the water retention symptoms at that point.
I know you do a lot to help prepare for labor and birth. First of all, there's positioning things, helping a baby get into the ideal position. And then also, as you get closer, sometimes, especially if you're up against a clock, medical induction, that people often seek out Chinese medicine for help trying to beat that clock.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about those two?
Yeah. Well, positionally speaking, we do a lot of work with things like breech position. I know you guys do a lot of that, too. There's a specific acupuncture point that we use, moxibustion, which is like a little herbal compressed kind of incense made out of a specific herb that's held over a point on the toe. And interestingly, it has a higher success rate for turning a baby into a cephalic position than the manual version. So it's certainly worth a try.
And it's been studied in both Eastern and Western
medicine.
It has,
and it has similar outcomes, although I did read a study that shows it has a much better efficacy in China. And
oh, really?
I think that that's because there is no resistance in China. Chinese medicine is viewed in equal, you know, equally with Western medicine. And so if the doctor tells you to do that, you don't think, oh, that's weird. You just do it. And so it does seem to work better there. That said, it is a really effective method, and it should be employed whenever possible. An issue we run into here is that we really want to do it at 32 or 33 weeks. And a lot of times women are not getting a positional ultrasound until 34 weeks.
They don't know their breech yet.
Yeah. So that's a bummer. When women are working with midwives,
bummer
you can actually feel they
it.
Suspect it.
You
What's
said,
that?
Bummer. Bummer.
Bummer.
That's
yeah,
a
they're
bummer.
A Frank bummer.
Frank bummer.
A Frank bummer.
What about, is it the same for rotation? Can you get things that you can do if the baby is sort of leaning on mom's back, skull to spine in a posterior?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. That's more of like a acupuncturist doula trick, I would say.
See.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, that's a little bit like, put your leg up on this thing while I stick a needle in and do some moxa. Not every practitioner is going to be that.
I had a nickel for every time I heard that phrase.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit more creative than probably the average acupuncturist does on a daily basis, or kind of using those rock and roll kind of positions that we see in the hospital while using needles. And so I think being around birth a lot makes it a little bit more
helpful.
Easy, yeah, helpful to kind of get that.
So in the final weeks of labor, what kind of things in Chinese medicine for getting ready for birth, or as we started to talk about getting the birth ball rolling?
I ideally like to work with patients starting at 36 weeks and see them weekly leading up to the due date, which we all like to put in air quotes because it's not real. But they have all the pressure of due dates coming at them. So helping, I think that the onset of labor, if you look at the way all mammals go into labor, they go under the bed. They go in a dark corner of the stall. They find a cave. There's a very strong biological imperative to get quiet, to get calm, and to feel protected. And we have women who are running around in LA traffic and working until they're 40 weeks or more and on the phone and fixing their nursery and screaming and yelling. And life is not doesn't slow down for this process. So when I can start to see a woman at 36 weeks, I'm helping them to transition out of that state and starting to help them become the cat in the closet and start to think about things in terms of what their biology requires in order for them to make this transition. So I do that in conjunction with providing herbal medicine, and there's some classic formulas that we use. One, my favorite one is called Protect the Labor Worry-Free Powder.
Oh.
And we started around 36, 37 weeks and provided all the way through until post dates. And then if a woman does go past her due date, then the acupuncture can get a little bit more aggressive in terms of more frequency. Sometimes I'll see people 2-3 days in a row. I use cupping at that point. I use something called gua sha, which is using a tool to kind of scrape usually along the sacrum and the lower back. It also has a similar effect to cupping, but it's a little bit more releasing of heat. And then, you know, again, just working really, really hard at keeping that nervous system in check so that from that place of calm, they are able, their body is able to recognize that it's a safe time for labor to begin. So
I just know so many people come in for one visit to our office after, you know, they'll hear from the doctor, you have 3 more days and then we're going to induce you. And now, of course, a lot of these people are past due, so who knows what happens. But literally, I'll do the body work to loosen up their body, release some of the tight muscles, ligaments, tendons, open up the joints with adjustments. And then they get acupuncture, and they're off to the labor and delivery unit, and they have their babies within 24 hours. It's kind of amazing.
It is. So, it is amazing.
You
is
made
amazing.
A believer out of me. if someone's going to have a cesarean birth, are there things that you do specifically to prepare for that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, not necessarily so differently. And I mean, I'm still going to provide them with herbs. I still want their body to be prepared in the same way. I think it's a little bit more afterwards, the way that we work with them and helping them to heal, helping to make sure the milk's coming in, that they're getting the opportunity to bond with their baby right away, to latch, and kind of managing their recovery a little bit differently.
Yeah. So how soon after somebody has a baby, either vaginal or cesarean, do you like to see them to help the body strengthen itself back up?
I mean, it depends. If I have the privilege of being their doula or working with them all the way up until birth, I will sometimes even go to the hospital to see them if the hospital is willing to let me do that. And if not, within the first week, ideally, you know, as soon as they're home, if possible. And then it's a tricky time. It's hard to retain patients during that time, and it's a time when they need it the most. So we offer home visits and things to try to at a discounted rate usually for immediate postpartum patients, just to try to keep that continuity of care going because there's such a lack of support for women.
And, yes, and you address the emotional changes, the baby blues, anxiousness, depression as it comes up, fatigue.
Yeah, and kind of honoring it that, like, you have a right to feel anxious and a little bit sad right now.
Well, I do. I'm Jewish.
Exactly. You get to be that way all the time.
It's built in. you have any last questions there? I've learned so much, and we can go for another hour and a half.
Yeah.
We'll have to have you back. We have to have you back anyway to talk about fertility, because that's another very strong area for you. And you wrote a book about it, Feed Your Fertility. Kristen.
Yes.
Did you have any other questions? You had a kid, so I'm just an observer.
No, I found all of it to be really interesting. Are there herbs, since you do help after also, and it is such a hard time, is there, because I know, and especially in other cultures, that 40 days after is like really imperative. Yeah. Are there things, do you do like anything for like a package or something to help women with certain herbs in that time? Or
absolutely. Yeah.
Like
I mean, everything from there are specific herbs we use that right away postpartum and then transitioning into herbs that are to kind of help resolve the lochia, bleeding, bring in the milk. And then again, it kind of becomes case by case. If someone's really anxious, the herbs will be catered to that. If they have low milk supply, they would be catered to whatever condition it is that they're dealing with. So it's very individualized. But I think that continuing to see your acupuncturist postpartum is really important because it's a really difficult time, and we're not set up anymore culturally to support women the way we used to. Chinese medicine has a similar concept called the sitting month, you know, at least 30 days. I mean, they go to some extremes that include, like, you don't get out of bed or wash your hair.
Or
and most of us don't choose that part.
You might not find it so anymore. Comforting.
I have one friend who actually really did it.
Really?
The whole thing, yeah.
Is placenta consumption part of Chinese medical?
You know, the answer is no.
Really?
It's a big misconception.
It's
there
an American
is
thing.
No literature
PLT.
In the Chinese classics anywhere that equates consuming one's own placenta postpartum wellness. And the only reference to placenta is an herb in the materia medica of Chinese medicine, but it's typically used in minuscule doses and typically in geriatric formulas.
Ooh.
So the
placental
consumption is actually not Chinese medicine. It's been used as such, but I've done a lot of research into this topic because I'm very curious about it and talked to kind of the foremost expert in Chinese classical medicine, and she's a translator, and she wrote her dissertation on the placenta specifically and the use of placenta in Chinese medicine. And she said there are no references.
I find it to be delicious.
Oh, good.
So, but I'm not Chinese, so that makes sense. Where can we find you online?
My business is called Mother Nurture Wellness, and my website is mothernurturela.com.
Oh, thank you again so much for being here and sharing your expertise.
My pleasure.
At home, thanks for listening to the Informed Pregnancy Podcast. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, send your suggestions to info@informedpregnancy.com and visit us online. You'll find lots more pregnancy and parenting media at informedpregnancy.com.